Hello and welcome to I Swear Mom I'm Doing Something With My Degree with Professor Rex. I'm not a real professor, but I do eat a lot of ramen. My interview guest today will be Dr. David Gracon. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Eastern Illinois University. I asked David to pick our musical feature today, so we will be listening to Fly Pan Am from Montreal, and we will be listening to their album Ceux qui en vont n'ont jamais vécu. You gave a talk at PCA, and you also, I think, hosted a roundtable or participated in a roundtable, right?
Yeah, there was a roundtable called Punk Pedagogy.
Okay. I didn't get a chance to attend that. What was that about? Punk pedagogy.
Basically, I've heard this term recently called punkademics, and it's like punks are people who have been really influenced by punk culture or have been participants of it for many years. Some of them end up in academia, and I think it's an easy transition to make because, especially if you're doing kind of critical work in academia, I think there's a lot in common with, you know, the sort of politics in punk and the politics that are addressed in academia within certain fields. So I do communication studies, and within that, I do critical cultural studies, and I question issues of power, whether it's in media representations or in media ownership, such as the political economy of media. So punk music was really, for me, doing that before I even got into academia. So I consider it to be kind of an alternative education that punk gave me. And lo and behold, I went to university and I was like, wow, these same ideas have been in the punk music I've been listening to for several years now. And they're just saying it differently. Sure. And so a lot of, you know, then I went on to become a professor. And that panel was actually about how can we take ideas from punk and integrate them in the classroom. So I was talking about how I do things with fanzines, so independent publications. Zines are DIY publications that, you know, they're often photocopied and crude, amateurish, and they can range from a whole, you know, they can cover a whole range of topics. So zines are something I do in my class, which, you know, there's a intersection between zine culture and punk culture. So that was one of the things I talked about on the panel, just like how, you know, teaching that kind of critical thinking and, you know, ideas of anarchism. I teach those in my classes, you know, but challenging power, challenging corporate power, challenging capitalism. These are pretty strong themes in punk. And so I think it's easy. I mean, I've been given the opportunity at my university to teach classes where I can really talk about these things. That's not always the case with people. So I teach a class called Alternative Media. And for example, we talk about, we'll actually listen to punk lyrics and we'll then connect that to the theory. How does the punk lyrics connect with, you know, theories like hegemony or colonialism or post-colonialism or gender representation, you know, but also the corporate power structures, this sort of thing. So I use those in my class, some of my classes, and I found it to be very, students are really into it and it's exciting. And so zines and, you know, actually analyzing punk lyrics and then, you know, connecting that to theories of subcultures. And
sure. So that not to be a complete asshole or anything, but the university system and academia and yeah, privileging education is very much a structured hierarchy.
Sure.
In a way that sort of is very not punk, right? Right. How do you reconcile those two concepts?
Those are things we've talked about, you know, on the panel. You know, is this a co-option of punk? You know, is talking about zines in a university, you know, sort of antithetical to the zine concept?
Right.
And I would say yes and no to that. I mean, one of the things about working in a university is the absolute freedom you have as a teacher. Bless you.
Thank you.
So one of the things you talk about, you know, or the situation of being a university professor, you're in a situation where you have the ability to pretty much do what you want in a classroom. Like, no one's overseeing my class saying, I can't do this, or I can't do that, or I can't talk about this or that. And, you know, yeah, the university is an institution, but there's a lot of critical work done in that institution that is very challenging of power.
Right.
But at the same time, it is a power.
Right.
And, you know, so there can be a contradiction in that. But I mean, I'm reaching more people through these ideas than any other vehicle I would have otherwise. So if I was doing a zine or making, you know, I still make film and video projects, but I think through teaching these ideas, it actually has more of an effect on those students. But my university is different than some of them. I mean, some other universities, whereas like a lot of my students are first generation college students. A lot of them, you know, their parents never went to college. So there's like definite like class issue, which I think relates to punk. I mean, a lot of early punk was about class politics, especially in the UK. So, I mean, there's a lot more radical stuff going on in universities than punk. So, I mean, I don't think radical politics or critical politics, I mean, university, that's the place for them, you know, the place to have critical thinking, media literacy, to be able to really try to change social structures is really at the focal point of cultural studies, is to actually not just talk about these things, not just critique, but how can we actually do and implement? So I think, you know, punk fits nicely within those discourses. And cultural studies itself has, you know, a lot of people say it's been co-opted, it's been watered down, it's been, you know, sort of stripped of its sort of political radical roots. Mm-hmm. And you can even see that at the ACA-BCA conference, because there's a lot of work that's presented there that isn't necessarily critical.
Right.
There's a lot of work that's like very laudatory, or just like, here, it's a celebration of this thing I like. But cultural studies, and that's fine if that's what people want to do.
But it's not, yeah.
But cultural studies at its core is really a critical approach towards society, towards art, towards media, towards teaching. But
and,
certainly,
and critical
it's not,
doesn't mean you don't like it, right?
What's that?
Critical does not mean you don't like it, right?
No, I mean, critical.
You can be critical of things you like.
Sure.
Okay.
You can be critical of things you like, but critical, you know, has in this sort of theoretical framework is used in a way that's like, we're not pleased with how this is being done. And like, what are some alternatives to that system? And how can we change that and like have other alternatives, say representations or methods of doing these things? But of course it's, people can say, you know, well, that's, you know, selling out or whatever. But I think a lot of, you know, there's a lot of punks in academia for a reason. It's because punk orients people to think critically. And it's I think it's a nice logical extension to go from that into teaching and to get other students to think critically about that, to embody those ideas. But of course, you know, universities are in a weird place right now because they're becoming increasingly more corporatized. Universities are becoming, you know, more vocational. You know, this whole idea of neoliberalism in the university is like, you know, what is that doing for these kinds of things that, you know, sort of punks are talking about in classes? Like, you can't necessarily take what I'm teaching and go get a job with that.
Right.
You know, but that's fine because I don't see the university as just a vehicle to find employment. I think of it as a place to think, to experiment, to get to know yourself, to get to know the world you're in, and to better navigate that once you have that knowledge and information. And I found students really react well to it. I mean, students really enjoy making zines. It's often their favorite thing they do in the class, and they do zines as a final project. And I think doing a zine actually allows them, it's kind of also a critique of academia because it allows them to write in a different way. They don't have to write in this way that's so structured or standardized. In a zine, wow, I can write, I can say I, and like I can write from my own personal perspective, and it can be like a diary and funny. And so I think that's a cool space, and students are really receptive to that because typically in academia you can't do those sorts of things.
Right.
I mean, depending, I mean, there's some small spaces where you could probably do that. But I think by doing zines, students, A, don't know what they are. And B, it's a good way to link theory and practice. And C, it's a cool way to express oneself in a way that's unorthodox. But it can still be doing these other things. So I think academia can be very rigid. So I think zines are a great way to counter that rigidity and like explore other alternative methods of way of communicating.
Punk has sort of a reputation for being very angry. Do you feel like that's something that you have to contend with on an academic level as well? I'm not saying it is angry. I'm saying it has the reputation. I mean, also it is. Yeah. It is kind of angry.
I mean, I think the word punk has so many different meanings. Mm-hmm. And I think at the core of certain kinds of punk, there is an anger. There's a frustration. There's alienation. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, that's true. I mean, there's certain elements of punk where that's the case. And that's a space in which to articulate and try to find a space in society where there isn't one. I mean, that's what I think punk is. And, you know, some people are very in an angry position trying to find that. You know, Ian MacKay in this documentary one of my friends made called Dither, you know, there's an awesome quote by him. It's my favorite quote of the film. And he's just like, we need punk because life doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah.
And like, it doesn't make any sense. And like, punk is a place, you know, where you can express these spaces in life that really don't make any sense.
Sure.
And so there can be an anger behind that. And for example, the stuff I have the students listen to in class can be very angry. But I think that's good for them to hear, because it's like, hey, it's okay to be angry and express this kind of frustration in such like a really visceral and powerful way. I think that's a good thing for students to experience, because I think a lot of students that I deal with are very passive, and like the idea of critiquing a society and being really angry about something isn't something I see very often. I think for them to hear punks being really angry and vocal and direct about things that are problematic in society, I think is awesome. It's okay to be angry and like, okay, well, what do we do with that anger then?
Yeah.
I think that's a healthy thing.
Yeah. It is. On the other hand, if you've ever had an argument on the internet, and I don't know, I kind of assume you have because most people have, there's always one person that's like, I don't know why you're getting so angry. Why can't we debate this like rational people?
Right.
Do you think that having that sort of anger and passion because maybe you're not part of the hegemony, do you think that's counterproductive in being rational and exploratory?
I mean, there's multiple methods to go about expressing oneself. And, you know, there's a lot of punks, you know, they're not necessarily angry all the time.
Right.
And I think it's partly the methodology of communication that, you know, especially it's through the internet and it's, say, through texting or whatever, or, you know, through message boards or whatever, these kind of discussions, threads, you know, it's easy for those messages to be misconstrued and, like, taken out of context and, like, which is probably why I don't get involved in a lot of those kinds of things, because, like, for me, it's not very productive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's something people can get really passionate about, and it's something that can be really contested. But I'm interested in aspects of punk that are sort of like, you know, the stuff I'm looking at in punk right now is like, why are there no black people in punk? Or like, why are there no women in punk? There are very few,
right.
I should say.
Well, and the ones that do exist are not given necessarily the same sort of attention that white guys are given. Yeah.
Right. So there's a hegemony within punk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like critiquing that and like, you know, what are these other alternative spaces, for example, for punk to exist? You know, it's like you look at Against Me and like the singer, you know, changed gender. It's like how many other music genres would that be totally accepted?
Right.
I mean, I think that's like a pretty radical thing to do, you know, but then I can't imagine like a huge pop star doing that and like the audience being really receptive to that,
right,
or maybe,
right.
I don't know. It just seems like there's a lot of really great things about punk, and the energy of punk is great and like very infectious. And powerful. And I think it's an important space for a lot of people who feel marginalized or, you know, sort of alienated or subcultural in society. But it's not without its problems too. And like, I think it becomes this like kind of normalized way of seeing when it is white male, for example. So there's, of course, you know, it's important to like critique those issues as well. Mm-hmm. So for example, I do a micro cinema here in my apartment. And it's a once a month gathering. Usually it's a screening, but sometimes it's like other kinds of performances. And it's like, you know, just like 20 people can come. And, you know, this guy, Sam, who's going to present his film called Dither, you know, his representation of punk is very white and male. And I'm like, well, how can we, you know, that's not enough just to show that film. I'm like, I need to show that film alongside another film that is offering a different point of view. And like, I'm interested in how those things like intersect with each other and like rub against each other in ways that are interesting. So I'm going to pair his film Dither with The Punk Singer, which is about Kathleen Hanna of Bikini Kill. So it's like, that's looking at gender and punk and like these. So it's like, I'm interested in like, how can these two films on the same topic tell very different stories and like, how can that be an interesting intersection of ideas? So I think it's important to like play with that. And like, things are constantly evolving and changing. Like punk isn't just some static thing. So it's important to like, there's a lot of progressive things about punk, but there's also things about it that are not so progressive. So I think having those kinds of dialogues are really interesting. You know, people of color in punk or queer people in punk, you know, and like, there's a lot of ideas of like, yeah, we're inclusive. Like this seems so inclusive. You hear this all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, look around. like it's not particularly diverse, you know, oftentimes.
All right. And let's take a quick musical break. We are listening to Fly Pan Am, and the song is Partially Sabotage Distraction, Partiellement Saboté.
We'll be right back.
how does punk engage with queerness? I'm not familiar with it, actually.
Well, I mean, that's not something I can speak to, like, with a great deal of authority. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know a lot of punk people in the scene and punk, you know, or sorry, I know a lot of queer people in punk communities, and that's certainly much more accepted.
Yeah.
But it is mostly straight, white, male. But I think punks, you know, there are some punks that are total idiots too. And like, you know, they might make fun of queer people. You know, right. You can find examples of that. So it's like to say all punk is necessarily progressive and open to queerness. You know, but there was a band called Pansy Division, for example, and that's like an all queer punk band, you know? And I think, and they were doing that in, I think, the 80s and 90s, and they're touring around. And it's like, you didn't, that's long before you heard of any like queer artists,
sure.
You know, that were sort of like out or like pop stars. So it's like that could, those things happened, had to happen in the underground. Like those things had to have a space, you know, in a space that's not the mainstream. Like that was before Nirvana broke. So that was before punk was like really mainstream. So a band like Pansy Division and writing those kinds of songs about being queer, you know, that's a pretty radical space. You know, there's a band called Screeching Weasel, and they have a song called I Want to Be a Homosexual, you know?
Okay.
You know, so it's like, and it's a song about how straight people can't handle being queer, you know? I mean, that's like a pretty radical idea. I mean, and that was, you know, that probably came out, I think, in the 80s, you know? So I think those are pretty avant-garde ideas. And I think those were circulating in punk long before, you know? I mean, I learned more about queer ideas from like zines and punk culture than anything else. And like long before the debates, you know, these debates have been really at the sort of front of the quote unquote cultural wars, you know, and punk has been exploring this stuff for a while, but I mean, certainly there's still problems within it. And that, you can't say like all punks are like open to queerness, because that's probably not the case. I mean, there's Nazi punks, right?
Yeah. I did notice that a lot of neo-Nazis seem to be co-opting the punk aesthetic.
Right.
What's that,
I mean,
about?
There's Christian punk, you know, there's like all, I mean, punk's been co-opted and reused in so many different ways, in which it can be really contradictory too. But I think most queer people would feel okay in a punk context. That'd be my assumption, but that's assuming punk queer people like punk, and not all of them do probably. Right. So, but you know, from my point of view, it seems like a radical space that's, you know, more open to that kind of discussion. So.
Yeah. So your roundtable was about how to intersect punk and pedagogy. So why though? Why do you want to get there, to that place?
Why integrate punk?
Yeah.
Punk. And I think it's a useful method to talk about things like theory.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, there's a lot of theories that are critically oriented, and punk is essentially talking about those things, maybe not so using an academic language, but they're talking about things in ways that are similar. And I think the energy of it and the excitement of it and the idea that anyone can do punk, I think, is exciting to the students. Like, I think that idea translates to learning. Like, anyone can do learning. Anyone can learn and be excited and have an energy about something. So like I said before, I think it's a useful way to explore those theories, because, you know, the students aren't used to hearing radical ideas, you know, and like you hear it in a punk, they can read some academic articles about radical ideas. They can listen to a punk song with radical ideas in it. And I think that can resonate in a different way. This idea that it's okay to critique and be angry and like, be really like upset about certain things in a society. So I think, I mean, I don't do this in all my classes. It's really just in a few sort of fringe classes where, you know, punk as a topic is actually even talked about. So, you know, so it's not like all my classes this is done, but I think, the students typically react really well to it. They didn't know about these histories. They don't really know about punk. They might know, you know, a few things about it, but so for me, anything that connects the theory to praxis or practice really well is an effective method. Yeah. And I think punk is just, you know, for me, punk links to like ideas of anarchism. And how can you link anarchism and education? And I think there's some interesting ways to do that. Like, of course, an academic institution is not anarchy by any means. Right. But you can take the methods from anarchism and use them in teaching, which I think can be exciting.
Well, that's really interesting because in this context, you're the authority, right?
Right.
Okay. How do you... Right. I don't even know how to make that a question exactly, except that right. you're the man in that situation.
You have to develop a classroom atmosphere where you're okay with questioning your own authority as a professor.
Okay.
And sometimes that works. And sometimes, you know, we even talked about this on the panel. It's kind of like, if you're teaching a bunch of these students to say, hey, fuck you to society. Mm-hmm. And I'm critiquing you and I don't need you. And we're going to develop our own things. There can be a tension with that in the classroom. So even if I am, you know, young professor who's maybe hip and like into punk and talking about these sort of punk things, like, at the end of the day, I'm still an authority figure. I still enter the grades. Mm-hmm. You know, I still have a power over them. You know, I stand in the front of the room and they sit in front, you know, and you can arrange, play with those arrangements, but ultimately I'm still an authority figure, you know, but there are, you know, alternative models of education where those things are challenged more. But ultimately, yeah. And that's something we talked about on the panel. So it's like, and some students aren't ready for it yet. You know, I think some students, there's a certain level of maturity you need to take on some of these ideas. And like, how can you do it effectively? Like, it's one thing just to say like, yeah, fuck you, I don't care.
Right.
But it's another thing to have a really valid critique and rationale behind that kind of anger or dismissiveness is a completely different thing. So I think to have a very articulate critique and way of dismissing something or wanting other alternatives, these ideas that punk values, you know, that's a good thing. But you can have students like that can push them so far to this kind of radical space where they don't know what to do with that yet. And sometimes they then want to usurp your power. And then like, well, that's kind of like what I'm teaching them.
Right.
So sometimes there can be some kind of uncomfortable moments, and then you kind of have to just, and I mean, that's not always the case. I mean, students are still usually really receptive of it and respectful, but you can have some students who take it to an extreme of like, yeah, well, I don't need to listen to you anymore. Why, you know, and it can even question an academic institution as a whole. Like, why do I even need to be here? So it raises, I think that raises some interesting questions. And then from there, you can take those questions and think about them and like unpack those and like discuss those things. And like, I think if you're a professor and you're being pushed into uncomfortable spaces, that sometimes could be productive. It's just a way of like, how do you deal with it? And like, you know, but ultimately at the end of the day, you're still an authority. But, you know, I try to play with that the best I can. And like, you know, I challenge things like, great, like, what do grades even mean? Why do we have grades? You know? So, you know, it can be complicated.
Sure. In terms of radicalness, one of the things that I hear talked about a lot is accessibility of things like education.
Sure.
And obviously there's also a huge problem with accessibility within a system like university, which not only has a set of expectations before one is allowed to enter, but then also it's fucking expensive.
Sure.
That I assume that's something that you also address in class?
Yeah. I mean, I talk a lot about class issues.
Yeah.
You know, as a professor, I try to reveal quite a bit about myself. So I talk about, you know, I'm from a working class family. Neither of my parents went to college or university. And I think that's something my students can relate to. You know, is academia accessible? You know, you have to adjust how you teach according to your audience. So, you know, I was at the University of Oregon where I did my PhD, and I taught at a very different level there than I do at my current university, which is more working class students, first generation college students. So in order, the accessibility issue is something you have to work with, you know, and you have to teach according to the audience you're in. So because the students from my university are more working class, they don't come to the university with this kind of cultural capital that students at the University of Oregon have. And, or even, you know, you could go up to the Ivy League and like, what kind of cultural capital all those students have going into that and privilege and this and whatnot. So, you know, I can relate to students who didn't even know how to apply to college. I can relate to students who had no help in applying to colleges from their parents, or like who were never even told to go to college. You know, same with me. I mean, my parents never said you have to go to college. It was just kind of like, oh, I guess this is what I do. I went to a community college because I was not a very good student in high school. So, yeah. So, I mean, those kinds of, you have to kind of know your audience in order to make it accessible. And that can mean really bringing things down to a level that are really, really accessible. And that's something I've had to do at my current university, Eastern Illinois University. You know, we have a lot of students from rural Illinois who are coming to the university. We have a lot of students from inner city Chicago coming to my university. And they're coming from backgrounds that are not privileged. And so that actually puts me in a good position to work with them, because I myself am also from that background. So there's no, and I think students can relate to that, and students, like, it's a good way to connect with them because we share similar backgrounds for the most part.
Sure, absolutely.
But I mean, I think the other part of your question was, first was about accessibility, and second was about, you know, the amount of debt and the cost. Again, those come back to class issues that, that comes back to, you know, why are universities increasing tuitions, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of state schools like mine have lost a lot of funding from the state, so they have to raise tuition as an alternative, you know? But as a result, our numbers are down. We're having trouble getting more students, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think economically it is an issue, and, you know, taking out all these student loans, and then that affects your life afterwards for many years. Like, it may, people may be hesitant to, you know, they can't buy a house, you know, they can't, you know, live this life. They have to really, there's not a lot of jobs. So in some sense, you know, I think you can do it on the cheap, you know, like I did. I went to a community college, very inexpensive. I didn't live in dorms ever, you know, that saved me $40,000 right there by never living in a dormitory.
I mean, a lot of schools require you to live in a dorm your first two semesters.
Right. But if you're like me, who started at a community college where there is no dorms,
right,
then you transfer in and you're then a junior, you then bypass those rules. So for me, I look, you know, when I hear these issues about all the debt and racking up debt, it's like, well, there are methods you can or there's methods you could do, or like things you could employ to do it more cheaply. So
there,
I say, I recommend,
if you know how,
go to a community college. You know, I would say that to everyone, you know, and then everything transfers over. And, you know, I saved at least $40,000 by not living in a dormitory. So, but, you know, but to look into, for example, funding your education and like student loans or government loans, like that in itself takes a lot of knowledge. I had no idea how to do that either.
Right.
You know? So yeah, there's a lot of issues. And, you know, one's class background certainly has a big effect on whether, you know, those things are more problematic for some people more than others. You know, if you come from a family that's highly educated, they have all kinds of resources to help you get to that university. They have a lot of resources that, you know, help you score well on the GREs, you know, the SATs, you know. So, you know, I think all of those things are a factor. But I think it's still necessary to have, at least as a bare minimum, a bachelor's degree. You know, if you don't have a bachelor's degree, I think, you know, you're at a loss. And, you know, there's statistics that prove you make more money with about every degree you get, you earn more money over a lifetime.
I mean, that's a little fucked up though, right?
So, I mean, earning power, you know,
yeah,
increases with every degree you get. And I'm not saying that's should be a main motivation, but that's a fact. So, I mean, if you just have a high school degree, it's unlikely that even if you have a bachelor's degree, you know, you're still not going to like somehow skyrocket in class status. You might move from working class to middle class. You know, right. That's like an idea, but I mean, it's not, I mean, beyond the economics, it's just like, you also can learn skills in a university that are very employable. You know, so I teach video production. There's lots of jobs in video production, in editing and working on film crews, you know, this sort of thing. There's a lot of, you know, not that I look at it as like strictly technical training and like you get this education and then now you're getting a job, but it helps when that's the case, especially if it could be something more creative or, you know. So yeah, it is a problematic system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's cheaper alternatives than, you know, for example, starting out at a community college. Like my university is very inexpensive relative to the other universities in Illinois. Compared to the University of Illinois, like my university is a bargain.
I want to switch gears a little bit real quick.
Sure.
To talk about your other presentation, which was about iTunes and indie music, yeah?
It was more about iTunes more broadly, but that's sort of in the picture a little bit.
I remember you kind of wrapped up talking about indie artists and how to support local music stores and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You want to give us a quick rundown of what your presentation was?
So I was interested in what does iTunes mean as a store? Like, how did they become so powerful in terms of selling and distributing digital music? How were they able to dominate that market? And what kind of effect does that have on, say, independent retailers? So to sort of segue into the project that I did at ACAPCA, and the project was actually called Through Being Cool, The Political Economy of iTunes. And Through Being Cool is a reference to Devo. There's actually a song called Through Being Cool. And the title of that is meant to evoke this idea, well, Apple is so cool, right? Like Apple's branding, Apple's advertising, Apple's design. It's very sleek. It's very hip. It's modern. It's cool. But few people are critical of that kind of power, that image. So it really ties into this idea of what's called commodity fetishism, which is this idea that we sort of obsess over different commodities. Like, this laptop computer is so amazing. It's beautiful. Or this new car or this new stereo system, et cetera. Even vinyl records, for example, they're kind of what we fetishize them. But we're interested in how those things make us feel, how, you know, the pleasure they give us. But we rarely think about the systems and structures that have brought those things into place. And if you look at those things, which is what my talk was doing and what this paper is doing, essentially I was interested in the policies and practices and structures that brought that power into being for Apple, and wanted to pick it apart, but then also suggest some alternatives to that system. So it's not just by magic that iTunes came to dominate the digital music market. There's a lot of things that influence that. And so it's essentially a critique of corporate culture. It's a critique of the implications of that kind of power and monopoly practices and what kind of effect that has on, say, music distribution. And then also providing alternatives to the system, because it's become such a cultural dominant. And I wanted to question that and challenge that system, which is really at the heart of political economy, which is an area of study where you critique who owns the media, you know, media concentration and power, and how that affects the kind of media we have access to.
So what kind of alternatives do we have?
Well, you could shop at independent record stores, for example. You know, you don't, I mean, I've never purchased music through iTunes ever in my life. And I have a pretty huge music collection. I personally prefer tangible music, you know, so I prefer to have a vinyl record, for example. So I think by purchasing vinyl records, and you can have the digital download card with many new releases. So if you have the digital music player, you can play the music on that still. So one alternative is to buy vinyl, for example. A second would be to support independent record stores. To me, I think it's a much more healthy experience to go into a store, talk to people, form relationships with people. People who work at the store, you run into people you know. That to me is a more healthy experience than just buying something and having it, you know, appear on your computer suddenly.
Okay. What if I don't have a record player?
Well, if you don't have a record player, you could still buy CDs.
Okay.
You know, if you don't have a CD player, you know, for me, I mean, I'm 37 years old, so I grew up straddling new and old media. Mm-hmm. But I still prefer records. I would still prefer to have a CD over MP3s just because for me, it's like an additional work or labor to then put that music on my phone, right? And like having everything on my computer, for me, I'm on my computer a lot through work.
Yeah.
And like, I like to not be a part of my computer, for example. So it's like, I get home at the end of the day and I'm like, I don't want this. I don't want to be near my computer at all. So okay. The idea of like listening to music through my computer, A, doesn't sound very good. And B, it's like a lot of work for me. If I'm always buying new music, then it's like into my iTunes store. Then it's like, I'm also using the iTunes store if I'm doing all of this.
Right.
And then, which I'm critical of, record stores, you know, supporting independent retailers, you know, there's, if you're really into digital downloads, there's alternative ways to buy them. You know, you can buy them directly from the labels oftentimes.
Sure.
You know, you could go to Merge Records and you can get the new Arcade Fire and download it through them. And it's more cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get a bigger cut of that fund too, you know? So it's like the money they get is divided differently than if you buy it through iTunes.
Sure.
You buy directly through Merge Records, the label, it goes directly to the label and the artist. And then there's no middleman with iTunes. So, I mean, that's more work though, because then you have to figure out which labels own all of these bands or what bands are affiliated to which labels. You know, and then you have to go to each one, and that could be more time consuming. You could actually save more money because essentially iTunes is a one-stop. You could get stuff from multiple labels instantaneously, but you could actually go to a lot of these labels and just buy directly through them.
Thank you so much for listening. And again, thank you to my guest, David Gracon. We are going to end with another song from Fly Pan Am. This one is Erreur, errance interdite par leur nouvelle possibilité. You can find Fly Pan Am at cstrecords.com.